Most have described the Civil War generation, at least those in the North, as a people who fought to free the slaves and save the Union. Others have described that generation as blunderers who stumbled into a war that could have been avoided. Which is the case? That is the subject of Fred Nielsen's conversation with historian James McPherson.
My guest, James McPherson, a professor of history at Princeton University, is the preeminent historian of the American Civil War. Among his many books are The Struggle for Equality, Abraham Lincoln and the Second American Revolution, and For Cause and Comrades, Why Men Fought in the Civil War. He is perhaps best known for The Battle Cry of Freedom, which received the Pulitzer Prize. Professor McPherson, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us, first of all, about the American people in 1860 on the eve of the Civil War. How many were there? How were they distributed by race, section, ethnicity?
Well, the population of the United States in 1860 was just under 32 million. Of those 32 million, about 13% were slaves, 4 million slaves in the South, and another 500,000 free blacks, about equally distributed between North and South. There were about 5.5 million immigrants in the country, which was about 17% of the whole population, or 20% of the white population. So it was a period of our history when the percentage of immigrants in the American population was as high or almost as high as it has ever been.
Only about 40 years, to use Lincoln's phrase, separated the Civil War from the American Revolution. The fathers were in some cases literally fathers or grandfathers. What did Americans of the Civil War era think of earlier generations, especially the founders?
They venerated the founding fathers, and in fact that had a lot to do with their motivation in fighting the Civil War. The tragic irony, I think, of American history is that Northerners and Southerners had a different conception of the meaning of the Revolution of 1776 that had founded the nation. Southerners looked back on that as the first war of secession, a war to achieve freedom and independence from what they regarded as a tyrannical government. And they said they were doing the same thing in 1861, that they were acting in the image of the founding fathers to form a new nation. Northerners interpreted the founding of the nation in 1776 as a great experiment in Republican government, in democracy, and that if secession could break up the government, it would destroy that experiment. It would destroy the nation established by those venerated founders. And so the way in which both sides look back at the generation of 1776 as the greatest generation so far in American history helped to fuel the passions that brought on Civil War.
There's a lot of talk about greatest generations these days, of course. And yet, some historians over the years have looked back at the Civil War generation not so much as a great generation, but as a generation of blunderers. The politicians especially have been characterized by some historians as people who could have, and indeed should have, avoided such a tragic war. How much truth is there in such accusations?
That was an accusation associated mainly with a generation of historians prominent in the 1930s and 40s. Called the revisionists. And I think they were partly influenced by their pacifism, their belief that the United States had gained nothing by its participation in World War I and should avoid, that wars at all costs should be avoided. And they looked back on the generation of the 1850s and 1860s and called them a blundering generation because they did not avoid that war. But those historians also tended to have a blind spot, I think, on slavery and race. Any compromise that would have prevented war in 1861 would, of course, strengthen slavery because it was the South's fear that the growing northern majority, which had elected Lincoln president in 1860, would threaten the future survival of slavery that prompted them to go out. So the only way they could have been brought back in, or the only way that secession could have been avoided, would be further concessions to slavery that would increase its power in the national government, would perpetuate its existence. And so, looking back today on that generation, if it had compromised and strengthened slavery, we might brand it the racist generation or the blundering generation because it failed to come to grips with the crisis that had arisen over slavery. So I am inclined not to to agree with the blundering generation interpretation. I think that this was an issue that had to be resolved, or as Lincoln put it, the tug has to come sometime, and better now than any other time. And even though it did eventuate in a terrible war that killed 620,000 people, it also resolved two of the fundamental questions that had plagued Americans right down to 1860. One was slavery, and the other was the question of whether this nation founded in 1776 would hold together or whether it would split apart into fragments.
We know, of course, how the war ended, and as you've mentioned, we know some of the things that the war accomplished. Of course, the men who went off to fight in 1861 and 62 couldn't have known the outcome. What led them, North and South, to fight?
I think both sides were motivated by a powerful sense of nationalism, as they understood it, associated with that question of their veneration of the founders' generation. Northerners said that they were fighting for the preservation of, to use a fairly common metaphor that they used, the preservation of the best government on God's footstool. That is, a preservation of a republic in a world where there were few functioning republics, preservation of a nation that they believed was the greatest nation on earth. Against traitors, against treason, they thought that they were fighting to preserve the nation from its destruction by traitors. Southerners thought that they were fighting to preserve a unique way of life from the threat of these black Republican Yankee abolitionists, to use some of the terms that they did, and they used them as epithets, for their southern way of life, for their southern institutions, for their southern culture. All of these phrases together described their sense of a southern nationhood. At first, on both sides, slavery was subordinate to this sense of nationalism, but slavery, of course, was very much tied up and tied in with this sense of a separate and unique southernness. And as the war went on, of course, Northerners increasingly came to see that slavery was at the root of the rebellion, to use, again, a very common phrase that was used at the time, and that there was no way they were going to preserve the Union unless they rooted out the cause of disunion, which was slavery. So even though slavery was subordinated to nationalism on both sides in the first part of the war, it couldn't stay entirely subordinated, and that's why by the time the war had reached 1863, slavery had become an essential part of what both sides were fighting for or against.
Almost certainly the war, tragic as it was, must have been a formative experience for those who went through it. How did it shape them?
For Northern veterans, it increased their sense of a stake in the nation, and especially in a united nation. I think it was a formative experience in the creation of American nationalism. It was that generation that wrote the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. These are all Civil War slogans, and they grew out of the Civil War experience and helped to create that heightened sense of American nationalism in the late 19th and early 20th century that has come on right down to us in the present. In the case of Southern veterans of the war, there was a kind of ambivalence about that experience. On the one hand, of course, they had fought to destroy one nation indivisible and to create a new nation. When they lost, many of them accepted that outcome and pledged their new allegiance, as it were, to the United States. And I think by the late 19th century, after a wave of reconciliation between blue and gray, the encampments and commemorations of the war that brought both sides together, Southerners, even though they had a kind of nostalgic commitment to the memory of the Confederacy and of their heroic underdog effort to win that war, nevertheless kind of clasped hands over the bloody chasm, or across the bloody chasm of the great divide of the Civil War, and rededicated themselves to a new sense of American nationalism. And of course the war institutionally greatly strengthened the central government of the United States. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments vastly increased the powers of the national government. In fact, six of the seven constitutional amendments, starting with the 13th Amendment in 1865, increased the powers of the national government and decreased the powers of the state. And so the war actually accomplished a pretty significant transformation in the balance of powers between the central government and state and local governments.
Historians use all sorts of categories to help understand the past: race, class, gender, ethnicity, for example. I wonder how useful you think generations are. Is there something that looking at generations would do to help us further understand America's past?
Well, my own feelings about the usefulness of generations as an historical category is a bit ambivalent. Partly that's because there are at least two meanings of the word generation. One is all of the people who happen to be alive at a particular time. So when we talk about the Civil War generation, we're talking about those 32 million people who lived in the country in 1861. Another definition of generation is a particular age cohort at a given time. That is the generation from people in their 20s and 30s, something like that. And because of that ambiguity, it's not always clear what people are talking about when they talk about a given generation. And if we're talking about all of the people who happen to be alive at a particular time, especially in the case of the Civil War, you're talking about people who had widely and radically different perspectives on that experience. One-third of them, of course, were associated with the Confederacy. 4 million of them, nearly 14%, were slaves. Many in the North opposed the wars. Many in the South were Unionists. So to talk about a particular generation like the Civil War generation, I'm a little bit reluctant to use that as a powerful category of analysis.
There are so many attempts now by people to talk in terms of generations, and as we all know, particularly to identify a greatest generation. As we close, just a couple of questions. I wonder what you make of the attempts to identify a greatest American generation, and if you have a nominee yourself.
Well, I think the current popularity of that concept grows largely out of Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation, and with the commemorations of the past 5 or 6 years associated with the 50th anniversary of World War II. There have been frequent references to the World War II generation, or the generation that experienced the Depression and World War II. And that has prompted then others to look back on the generation of the Revolution, the generation of the Civil War. I think that helps to account for the popularity of this concept. I suppose, since I am a Civil War historian, I would have to nominate that generation as the one that came through the greatest crisis that this country has ever experienced, and resolved that crisis in a way that laid the groundwork for future expansion of the United States. The existence, the survival of the United States was not at stake in 1940. It was at stake in 1860. So I guess I would have to nominate that generation as the one that came through the greatest crisis in the American experience, and did so in the end with flying colors.
We have only less than a minute left. I wonder if there's a kind of historical pattern here. The World War II generation, now half a century after World War II, is receiving this veneration. Was there a similar kind of veneration half a century after the Civil War for those who fought in it?
Yes, I think so. Accounts of the Civil War the memoirs by participants began to achieve an enormous popularity in the 1880s and 1890s. General Grant's funeral in 1885 attracted millions of people and an enormous outpouring of memorialization and praise and so on. The 50th anniversary commemorations of the Civil War from 1911 to 1915 attracted huge numbers of people to various encampments. There were hundreds of thousands who participated in or witnessed the joint blue and gray reunion at Gettysburg in 1913. President Wilson came to it and gave a speech. So yes, there was a kind of veneration 50 years later of the Civil War generation that I think in many ways is comparable to what we have experienced in the last several years with respect to World War II.
Well, Professor McPherson, thank you for visiting with us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to do so.
I've been speaking with James McPherson, author of The Battle Cry of Freedom, among other books on the Civil War. His most recent book, an edited collection on the American presidents, is entitled To the Best of My Ability.